it's really a pleasure to have you know Dr. Green. He was visiting his parents. His father's a professor at U of T, and I happened to be in Thornhill over Shabbos, and we were sitting next to each other in shul. So what are you doing? I don't really know him so well. So he said he just got his, PhD in Ralbach. So I said, oh, great, we're doing a program in Tanakh. Do you want to come and speak? So that's why he's here. We always try, really, one of the things we do at Torah Motion very often over the years is we bring in, young people who may not yet be well-known in the community. One day they will be. And it's really, he just got his PhD at U of T. He got, I believe, a master's at Hebrew U. And he's now living in the great metropolis of Buffalo, New York.
Yes.
And he's teaching at SUNY, an assistant professor, and it's really a pleasure to have him here to speak on Ralbach, the moral imperative and the thought of the Ralbach. Bakasha, thank you very much.
Thank you so much also for inviting me.
My pleasure.
I'm going to pass around a handout. You're not going to understand at all what it means, but hopefully by the end you'll have some greater. Thank you, everyone, for coming. It's really my pleasure to be here in Toronto. It's nice to see so many Jews, because in Buffalo, there's a couple less. And, when I tell most Canadians that I live in Buffalo, the impression they have is that Buffalo, it's, the Galleria Mall, it's the Bills, and it's lots of snow. And I can confirm the snow is true. We had the second worst snowfall in the U.S. this year, 110 inches of snow. Second only to Erie, Pennsylvania. So I do spend my time shoveling. I do spend my time also going to the mall once in a while. But I also spend my time studying the Ralbach. So, and that's why I'm here today, not to talk about shoveling. You've had enough snow and ice in Toronto. You don't need to hear me talk about that. And before I got the job in Buffalo, I did my PhD at the University of Toronto under my advisor, who actually is a member of Sher Shemayim, you probably know. Professor Novak, and I did it on Ralbach or Gersonides. Has anyone here heard of Ralbach or Gersonides? That's pretty good. That's impressive. So a lot of people know of him. Many people have heard sort of bits and parts of what he said, but he is, in some ways, I would suggest, a forgotten biblical interpreter. Or at least he's marginal in a lot of Jewish discussions. He's not a central figure. You don't see him quite as prominent as Rashi, Ramban, Abarbanel. Sometimes Gersonides or Ralbach is in there on the side. So let me give you a bit of a short biography of who he is. So start off with a bit of a bio, personal history. What do we know about him and his life and work? So Rabbi Levi ben Gershom, Gersonides, also known as the Ralbach, his acronym. He lived in Provence in southern France from 1288 to 1344. And this was really the pinnacle, the center for Jewish scientific and rational thought. I don't mean that Jews other places did not think rationally, but I mean is that those pursuing science and sort of scientific discoveries and really sort of working on the interplay of Judaism and philosophy were living in Provence at this time. This was really the center for this type of thinking. And many of the students of Maimonides, the Rambam, who many of you know, really were living in Provence. So this was sort of the hotbed of what you call Maimonideanism. People who were influenced by Maimonides, by the Rambam, living in southern France, and those working on translating many of the great philosophic works within the Jewish tradition and also outside the Jewish tradition into Hebrew. There was also a large translation movement going on at the time. Many great works of Aristotle and other thinkers who, are not Jewish. You can pretend they're Jewish if you want, but they're not. Aristotle, as far as we know, wasn't Jewish, were being translated into Hebrew at that time. And Gersonides was one of these thinkers living at that time. And he wrote, one could say, perhaps some of the more important Jewish philosophic works of the Middle Ages. He wrote a work called Milchamot Hashem, Wars of the Lord, which he lays out six places where he felt the Rambam got wrong. So this, and he's trying to, in some ways, correct it, even though he was very much influenced by Maimonides. He was trying to have a different direction in rationalism. He was also an astronomer. He produced significant astronomical writings. And he was hired by the Pope, so he wasn't just living in a little bubble. He actually worked for the Pope at the time. The papacy was in what was called Babylonian exile. So it was in exile from Italy at the time. It was in southern France. And the Pope brought him in to do astronomical research.
He's in Avignon.
Pardon?
Avignon.
In Avignon. So he was living right in Avignon, yes. And he worked with other Christians, and he was well known at the time for his astronomical research. He was also an inventor. So, how many people could say, you're going to see all these things he did. He was sort of like a jack of all trades. He was also an inventor. He created a tool, which he called Jacob's staff, to measure the distances. Oh, my talk is so wanted. Someone called me right in the middle. My father-in-law. I'll hang up. You'll apologize to him if you see him later. He created this tool called Jacob's staff, which would measure the distance between different celestial bodies. And many of you might not know, there's even a crater on the moon named after him. He also wrote Hebrew commentaries on almost all of Tanakh. Almost all. Not every book of Tanakh, but a lot of Tanakh. And he wrote what's called Hebrew super commentaries on almost all the works of Aristotle. And Aristotle was the great scientist at the time, and he commented on much of the work of Aristotle. So he was very prolific. So he was a commentator both on Torah, on Aristotle. He wrote his own philosophic works. He was an inventor. He was involved in Christian society. He was a scientist pursuing different scientific discoveries. So he was very busy. Now, we don't really know much about his personal life, so maybe he didn't have much of a life, as we call it. He was really busy writing. I don't know. We don't really know what he did in his free time. We don't know who his parents. We don't really know about much who he married, if he had kids, or who he ever had. Did he ever have anyone over for Shabbat? We don't really know. So his personal details of his life are still a bit of a mystery. So why was he forgotten? And I'm suggesting that he was forgotten for a while. And why did he become less prominent? Well, actually, his commentaries in the Torah were some of the first Hebrew printed commentaries. When Hebrew books began to be printed in the 1490s in Italy, his commentaries were some of the first that were printed in Hebrew. And his commentary on Iyov, on Job, and also on Nevi'im Rishonim, on early prophets, were in some of the earlier Mikra Gdolot. Some of the earlier versions of the Mikra Gdolot. You can come in, make yourself at home. His commentaries were in the early versions of the Mikra Gdolot, suggesting that he was very popular at the time in the 15th century. That's already 100 years after he died. But at the same time, he's also very much criticized by thinkers such as by commentators Jabbar Benel, Isaac Arama. So he had his antagonists as well. And why was it? Part of it may have been due to the criticism of philosophy and the turn towards Kabbalah in the 16th century. So at a certain time, philosophy and science became much less popular in the Jewish world, and Kabbalah became much more accepted as the science or the way of approaching God and the way of thinking about the world. And philosophy became much less popular. And Ralbag, you could say, perhaps became a scapegoat for that. And many, therefore, criticized his approach as being too scientific, and his work, Wars of the Lord, was famously criticized as being, by one thinker, wars against the Lord. So that's a famous quote many people have heard. Notwithstanding this, he never completely disappeared. So he had his constant defenders. So he never, we still know about him, we still have his writings, and they are still around. And many of those who still valued his work much later on reprinted it in the 16th century in Italy, and later on also in Poland in the 19th century. So even though he had his critics, he also had his defenders. And in the 1950s, Rav Moshe Feinstein famously wrote a haskama to a new reprinting of his Gersonides' commentary on the Torah, stating, and I'll quote him, "I hope that everyone will purchase this book at full price and with happiness. May the merits of the Ralbag stand for the Torah, honorable Torah sage. May God grant him success in all his endeavors with the blessings of a friend and relative who values him greatly." So you can analyze that quote at your own time. Maybe I'm not, I don't know how much, I don't know if he studied all of Ralbag. I don't know the full story behind it. I know Professor Menachem Kellner has an article where he discusses, perhaps he knew some of his commentaries on Nevi'im Rishonim, but he wrote a nice haskama either way. So, but you could say over the last 40 years, we've witnessed what I maybe call a Gersonidean renaissance. What do I mean by that? I don't mean that, on everyone's bookshelf you're going to see Ralbag's commentary on the Torah, but I mean that his writings have become much more studied. So his theological work, Wars of the Lord, has been translated to English.
The JPS translator, put out three volumes of
the Torah. Yeah. That's what I'm referring to.
The book that was least bought.
Is it? Was it? I wasn't aware of that. Well, they still printed it nonetheless, but
they printed it and you get it for a dollar.
I wish I could get it that cheap, but you can tell me where to buy it then. Mosada Rav Cook has their version. I was going to say, so they put out there, and there's also a new version which I was going to talk about next, but it's commentary on the Torah. So Mosada Rav Cook doesn't have a version of Milchamot Hashem, not that I'm aware of, but of his commentary on the Torah, they have a version. So Mosada Rav Cook is their version. Also, is a critical edition being put out by two rabbis at Yeshivat Meledumim, Rabbi Carmiel Cohen, Rabbi Brock Brenner. Maybe some of you know them. I met with them when I was there, and they're going through all the manuscripts, critically editing and putting out a great edition with notes at the bottom. It's a green volume. You can actually also buy it from Koren. So they're really putting a lot of work into bringing back his commentaries to Torah, which they're much easier to study thanks to those. And even his commentaries on Aristotle, which were much more lost in the sense that Jews were not really studying them for a long time. Many Israeli scholars are also looking at them and bringing out new editions of them. And we've had them in manuscript. So I think it's a great time to study the Rabbah. I haven't told you anything about him yet, so, you know, I'm just giving a little history. But you're going to ask me, why should I care about his thought? What is there that he has to say? And maybe perhaps related to our theme today, as a parshan, what does he have to say that one cannot find in Rashi, Ramban, or Abarbanel? So I'm going to lay out three different things, and this is the way I'm going to frame today's shiur. Number one, the first one is more technical, in the sense that the way he structures his commentary on the Torah is in a way that is quite unique. He, after every parsha, he breaks it up into three different types of lessons. He has his Toaliyot HaDeot, which are his lessons on science, his Toaliyot HaMidot, which are his lessons on ethics, and his Toaliyot HaMitzvot, which are his lessons on halakha, law, or the commandments. So he has these three different types of lessons that come after every parsha. And this is largely consistent throughout his commentary on the Torah. Not everyone. Nevi'im Rishonim, he doesn't always have that distinction. But this is in the introduction of his commentary, he says, I'm going to teach you these three throughout the commentary on the Torah, and I'm going to break it up so you can distinguish the importance of each. Now, my interest, as you can see by the title, is his ethics, and that's the side I'm going to focus on. There's a lot of, also you could say, on the other topics. I'm going to focus on the Toaliyot HaMidot, his ethical lessons. And here's where my second point comes in. I argue that he has two central but conflicting ethical models, and what I call his ethics of egoism and his ethics of altruism. And anyone know what I might mean by those very ambiguous academic terms, which you probably don't hear a Sherish mind very often? Well, by ethics of egoism, I mean the necessity to look out for oneself, the concern for one's own self-interest. And there is an important drive, an important concern, that one sometimes has to look out for oneself first. On the other hand, there's also, he argues, a concern to look out for others. There is an importance to care for others, notwithstanding who they are. And I call this the ethics of altruism. How can one benefit others and help them improve? And he develops each of those through different character traits. There are traits which one should cultivate to focus on oneself, and there are also traits that one should focus to benefit others. In this sense, the title today's talk is not 100% accurate, but I can come back to that later. So there are these two types, what I call two ethics, the ethics of egoism, the ethics of altruism, two different types of character traits which one has to cultivate. And the third point I want to make is that he also shows an awareness of what I call moral conflict. How does one reconcile different conflicts one faces in one life between competing goods? And there are times when one is going to want to focus on one's own physical needs, one's family, one's property, one's iPad. And other times one is also going to discover that that peace and the cessation of conflict is going to be a competing good. Sometimes peace, making peace, is more important than focusing on family issues. And how do you reconcile the two? Or a third of good is God's commands. What happens if I face a conflict and God commands me to do something, but at the same time, if I follow that command, I may not have enough money to live. I need to go, you know, make a living. Or if my family tells me to do one thing, God tells me to do another. How do I reconcile that? So what I'm suggesting, there are three. In his commentary, he recognizes, and this is where the triangle that you see at the bottom of your page is, I'm trying to develop that there. There are these three goods, and how does one balance the needs of each one? Or how does one balance the importance of each one. When two out of the three come in conflict, how do you weigh your decision making in light of one or the other? So that's something I'm going to talk briefly about today as well. So how does he define? I'm going to go back to what I call the ethics of egoism and the ethics of altruism, and you'll see that at the top of your sheet. I put those words out there. And for Gersonides, when he talks about oneself and one's own physical self, and about doing things for one's own physical well-being, a lot of it comes down to luck or chance. There's a lot of luck or chance in the world. And a lot of life, some of life, may come down to being lucky. And here I'm going to talk about how he reads Aristotle. Yes, this is the only talk today where you're going to hear about Aristotle in connection with the Torah. As far as I know, I don't think anyone else mentioned him. What do I mean by that? Aristotle famously defines chance in two ways, or luck in two ways. The first way is, he says, what's two ways you can define luck? One way of defining luck is in relation to frequency. What do I mean by that? Aristotle says nature happens in patterns. So a lot of things happen very frequently. The majority of many things in the world, many ways in the world, things happen in the majority of things happen. The majority of cases happen in one way, but there's always exceptions. And I think you see that a lot in life. A lot of things, people act many ways in a certain way, but sometimes you see an exception to the rule. And one way of defining luck, he argues, is something that happens rarely or infrequently. And these, he argues, these infrequent events are called chance. For example, the odds of lightning hitting an individual are rare, but it does randomly happen. Chances are, most of the time you walk down the street, you're not going to get hit by lightning. But once in a while, it does happen. So for him, he would argue this is chance. Now, the second of Aristotle's definitions is in relation to a goal or purpose. So one is about frequency, one is sort of like a rarity of frequency. The other one is about goal or purpose. What do I mean by that? So according to Aristotle, most events in the world have a purpose. But a chance occurrence is a result of an accidental encounter between two actions, each with their own goal, that results in a new chance event. For example, and this would never happen in Toronto, definitely not in Buffalo, a student did not hand in their essay on time. I punish my students severely for such crimes, usually death, but, you know. Yes, exactly. Purely hypothetically, of course. What did you say? You're right. I should be more lenient. Thank you for
Kill him again.
Oh, kill him again. Exactly.
Then it's no longer chance.
Yeah, exactly. So, student did not hand in their essay on time. Was on the way to the supermarket, and the teacher happened to be there picking up some groceries, and they run into each other in the milk aisle. And the teacher used the opportunity to severely scold the student and give a stern warning about late submission policy. Thus, each had their own goal. The student was going to get milk, the student buying something at the supermarket, the teacher was also going to the supermarket, and the fact that they happened to have met at that same time was chance, according to Aristotle. And the chance event is there coinciding, creating a new chance occurrence. Now, according to Gersonides, he interprets this and says that we have the opportunity, and as humans, to overcome these forces of chance. The Torah gives us the opportunity to overcome these forces by letting us cultivate certain character traits. And the first one he has is hishtadlut, which can be translated as effort or endeavoring. And he defines hishtadlut in his biological writings as a key feature of nature. He says that nature endeavors, ishtadel hateva, and I might have brought that in on the quote you have on your page, to preserve the existence of its creatures. And it sounds almost like Darwin, when Darwin talks about the struggle for existence in nature. What does this entail? And according to Ralbag, we all have certain organs that are necessary for living, for preservation. The more complex a being we are, the more complex organs we are. Therefore, certain animals have horns that allow them to fight off predators. Other, such as bees, can make hives and have the ability to produce honey. And for humans, we have the ability of our mind. And that ability allows us to do great things. We have the ability to make homes. We have the ability to, for shelter. We have the ability to create tools for farming or make tools for cooking or food or hunting. As humans have this ability for creative thinking, which he calls hishtadlut. Now, how does this connect to his commentary on the Torah? You're probably wondering where I'm going with this in terms of his commentary on the Torah. No one was wondering that question. I'm glad you were okay with where I was going with it then. Well, he uses this method that I'm talking about to, in his Toaliyot Midot, in his ethical lessons, to interpret the hishtadlut of certain characters in the Torah. One example, I'm going to bring a few examples how he uses hishtadlut, and he attributes hishtadlut to certain important characters and the actions of certain characters. In Bereshit, in Genesis 16:2, Sarah is having difficulty conceiving, and Sarah suggests to Abraham that he should have a child with Hagar, since Sarah has been having difficulties conceiving. And Gersonides interprets Abraham and Sarah's actions as employing the creative thinking of hishtadlut. So hishtadlut is the creative ability to find other means that will make success most likely. So if one method doesn't work, use another method to succeed. We as humans have the ability for creative thinking in those regards. We can create new methods. If one method doesn't work, we'll find another way to do it. Another example, and this is part of that, one could say, is obtaining the next best good when the perfect one doesn't come around. And we see this in Bereshit 24:8. When Abraham's servant Eliezer is sent to find a wife for Isaac from the old country, and according to Gersonides, Abraham allows Eliezer to take a wife for Isaac from the daughters of Canaan, if one from the land of Abraham would not follow Abraham back to Canaan, which is the second best option. So the ideal was from Mesopotamia, second best option from Canaan. And this is how Ralbug reads Abraham's statement that thou shalt be clear from this my oath. Ambiguous statement. What does it mean that you're clear from the oath? So Ralbag interprets that to say, well, if you really can't find anyone back in Ur Kasdim or around that neighborhood, then I give you permission to look in Canaan as a second best option. So Ralbag says and he uses the term hishtadlut in both these cases, that hishtadlut is a creative way to find ways to ensure one's progeny and one has children and one's family continues, using alternative means when the first option that Abraham desired may not have been available or may not have worked out in his favor. So that I'm going to lay out is the ethics of egoism. Now I'm going to go to what I call the ethics of altruism. And Ralbug doesn't quite lay this out as organized as I am. He's just interpreting the Torah, but I found these hints and I'm putting them together in this way. And this second ethic, which I call the ethic of altruism, is we learn by imitating God. God is the paradigm for altruism for him. What do I mean by that? What do I mean that God is the paradigm for altruism? Well, how do we answer the problem of why does a perfect God create an imperfect world? God doesn't seem to have any necessity in creating our world. It's not, he doesn't need our world. And this is one of the big debates among many. We've shown him how do we explain the fact if God's perfect, why does he need to create something imperfect? And the Kabbalists have an explanation that God sort of, or at least Kabbalah, Lurianic Kabbalah, Kabbalah Ta'ari, that God sort of withdraws from himself and makes a space there. But we see also, and many among the philosophers, we see a different option. We see an idea that God overflows. We have instead of it that not that God withdraws within himself and makes a space for the world. The philosophers described it that God sort of, there's almost like an overflowing of the pot. God's so perfect, there's so much coming out of the pot that some overflows into our world, and our world is sort of an outcome of that. So, either way, however you look at it, God's loving kindness is from the fact that he created the world with no personal interest. There's no claim, God didn't have to create the world. There's no necessity to create the world for God, but he did so nonetheless. And this is therefore a way if we have to imitate this form of creation in our own actions. This sort of altruism, just how God created it for no personal benefit, we have to imitate God also in acting towards other people for no personal benefit. And we almost see this, in discussions in the Gemara, which discuss God's attribute of loving kindness, his chesed, to the obligation to clothe the naked, visit the sick, and comfort the mourner. But Ralbag interprets altruism slightly differently. Altruism is not just about that, there's something else. There's a scientific element. And this is where altruism for him is not just about how you act towards others, but there is something about knowledge. Knowledge is important for him. It's about God. It's in the sense that God's loving kindness is expressed in the way he constructed the world with a certain order. So God created the world in a certain order. And we as humans can understand that order. And God, his and the loving kindness that Ralbag describes is the ability to spread that knowledge of, you could call it intelligent design, or how God created the world, to others. And he raises this in your quote on the sheet under the Ethics of Altruism, where he says, right in the beginning of his theological work, Wars of the Lord, he says, "It is not proper for someone to withhold what he has learned in philosophy from someone else. This would be utterly disgraceful. Just as this entire universe emanated from God for no particular advantage to him, so it is proper for someone who has achieved perfection to try to impart it to someone else. In this way, he is imitating God as best as he can." And this is Ralbag's way of also interpreting the shepherd. The shepherd is not just someone who leads flock around, but is a paradigm for, as a teacher, a paradigm for someone who spreads knowledge to others. It is a metaphor, in a certain sense. The shepherd is not just the physical shepherd, but the traits of the shepherd, and the shepherd itself, the character of a shepherd, is a metaphor for a teacher. And therefore, he sees the shepherd as someone who rationally, just how a shepherd leads his flock, the teacher has to guide the flock of the world by teaching them knowledge of the world. And therefore, pedagogy is the greatest form of altruism for Gersonides. So I've laid out these two models here. The ethics of egoism, which is finding ways to physically survive, physically persevere in the world, and the ethics of altruism is a form of pedagogy. And these two are important. We see them throughout Ralbag's commentary on the Torah. Now, sometimes we see conflicts too. And these two are not so, they don't always so neatly fit together. And we see at times there are examples of conflict between the two, and even more so between these three goods which I'm laying out. What were the three goods that I suggested? See if you remember. Now I'll make it interactive. It's actually on your sheet. What I suggested, the three are family and property, peace, and God's command, or divine law. Sometimes these three come into conflict. And how do we reconcile the three? Now, Gersonides presents, or Ralbag presents one way, his model of how we can reconcile these conflicting demands when they come into conflict. And I'll give you some examples from his commentary on the Torah. You could say this is almost an example of conflict resolution. How do we resolve conflicts? And they're probably conflicts that we all face in our own life. Which good do we take as prior? Or how do we prioritize certain goods? So you can see this triangle that I put on your handout here. And I noticed on the triangle I put three different things, three different names at different corners, I think. And the check mark is an example of if two conflict, which side are you supposed to choose? Or which side is better to choose? So the first example is human physical needs, such as family property. And he argues that one should prioritize that over God's command at times, since the need for physical preservation is a prerequisite for fulfilling those commands. How does the expression go? In Kemach in Torah? Is that, am I quoted correctly? Similar to that. And he talks about that. You can see an example in his commentary in the Torah, right? Yes?
But does he come to that, so to speak, independently from reasoning? Or does he go back to the Torah and say it says the Chaybah as justification for that?
Well, we can discuss that afterwards. Let's look at the examples, and you can tell me what you think. See, I answered a question with a question, but by avoiding your question. Right after Abraham is commanded by God, Lech Lecha, to leave his home, go to Canaan. Right as he gets there, there's a famine, and Abraham has to make a decision: is he going to leave or is he going to stay? And of course, Abraham stays, and he leaves, and he goes down to Egypt. And many of the commentators debate: was this a good thing? Did he do it? Did he do the right thing? Did he do the wrong thing? Ramban is very famously says that he commits a great sin there. He should have stayed, but he didn't. But What does Rabbi say on that, on this point? And the question of whether he should stay or whether he should go is that for Gersonides, God praises Abraham's choice to go, proposing that it is not, in fact, a rejection of God's command. So it's not that he rejected God by leaving Canaan and going down to Egypt, but that God's command does not apply to every circumstance. So he's not actually going against God's command by leaving. God told him to go. He still went. But he just left for a little bit. He had to get some food, go to the grocery store down in Egypt, and he'll come back afterwards. It wasn't the right time to be there. So the way Ralbag solves this problem is he says that yes, true, Lech Lecha was a general command, but there's an exception. And sometimes if you need food and you're really starving, you temporarily leave and then you come back. So food and these physical necessities at times outweighs directly following God's command. Not that he's saying you should, not follow God. He didn't say Abraham shouldn't have gone to Canaan, but that at the time he had to prioritize leaving for the sake of one before he could fulfill the other. This is the example I want to bring in for that first conflict, the conflict between physical demands and God's commands. But there's another conflict, and you see this in your triangle too, the conflict between peace and the physical desire for property. So you get in a fight with someone over property, and you can keep suing the person endlessly. This happens in the U.S. a lot. People like to sue endlessly. In Canada, I don't know if we do it quite as much, but lawsuits still go on here too. Oh, okay. So that's the reason. That's part of the reason why. So when do you decide that you should keep suing the person endlessly? And when do you say, and especially maybe if it's a family member, or when do you say, I'm going to stop. It's better. Peace should outweigh whatever I'm going to benefit from that conflict. So the conflict between peace and the physical desire desire for property or any sort of human good. And his argument is that peace sometimes is a more effective way of preservation than just driving for more, the endless desire for more and more and more. Sometimes we just have to sort of say, let's just stop fighting and we'll agree to let it be, as opposed to continuously saying, I need more and more of physical goods. Maybe it means acquiring one less iPhone. I still don't have an iPhone, by the way. This comes into play in the Torah in Abraham's endeavor to acquire possessions. And he emphasizes how Abraham many times always is cultivating the virtue of hishtadlut. Abraham is always trying to get more property, more goods for himself. But he was willing to give it up to make peace with Lot. And it was better for him to make peace with Lot over the endless desire for property. Avram, he said, prefer less grazing and greater peace over an abundance of land and strife. And you see a similar case in how he's interpreting Avraham's rejection or throwing out of Hagar from his home. You could say that why did Avram, Hagar and the progeny that would come from Hagar would have been a big, great benefit to Avraham. More kids, more future benefits that would come from that. But Ralbag says that no, Abraham wanted to keep Shalom Bayit with his wife and listens to her command over the desire for more progeny, more benefit that's going to come from that.
Didn't he ask God about that? I mean, this isn't something that he wanted to do. This is something he was very uncertain about.
Yes, so I think that would be the answer, that he listened to his wife in this case. And his wife and Ralbag interprets this as a case of Shalom Bayit, where the peace within the home took priority over his future children with Hagar and Ishmael. Well, Ralbag's not following every view, in the Medrash. He's picking and choosing what works for him.
Don't we all?
Yeah, exactly. He is. I'm not suggesting that he's following every interpretation. Doing okay for time?
Yeah. 15 minutes.
Perfect. So here's the third case. What happens when God's command and the desire for peace come into conflict? Which one do you pursue? if God's command is following something that God's command is going to cause you to create strife with others, do you follow God's command even if you have to stand up, maybe create trouble in society, or do you say, well, I'm just going to ignore something and let peace is more important, creating peace among people. And I created two arrows on your sheet by the fact that at different times he interprets it one way, and other times he interprets it the other way. There are times that God's command takes priority, and other times that peace should take priority. In one case of a character in the Torah standing up for God's law in the public sphere against leaving the issue alone for the sake of peace is Abraham's challenge to King Abimelech over the act of theft committed by his servants. Abraham, you could say, could have ignored the matter and not mentioned it to the king. Therefore, you know, avoiding perhaps putting himself in danger. But instead decided it was worthy of mention in order to chastise Abimelech. This is an example for all bug of standing up for God's command against stealing, against just ignoring what Abimelech's servants did. Another example is Mordechai's act of informing the king about the murder plot against him, which is interpreted by Rabag as the case of working for the peace of the king. Similarly, the case of Mordechai's unwillingness to bow down to Haman, and Mordechai knew the dangers associated with not bowing down to him, yet he did not seek a peaceful compromise. And of course, there's interpretations. Other interpretations was just that he may have had some kind of pagan symbol around his neck or something like that. And he argued, according to Rabag, that standing up for God in this case was more important than ignoring what Haman was doing, and that the peace he could have had with Haman potential peace he could have had with Haman was not as important as standing up for God in this case. And at the same time, we also see examples in his commentary of achieving peace over following the divine command, following God's command. And we see one example of this in the case of Joseph and his brothers. The brothers' willingness to lie for the sake of peace and reconciliation with their brother is an example of breaking the prohibition of lying, he argues, for the sake of peace. Joseph's brothers fabricated a story about how their father commanded them to report to Joseph after his death in order to forgive them for all their sins. And Gersonides, Rabag, states here that it is appropriate for man to endeavor to achieve peace as far as possible. And he also says, it is inappropriate that the desire to stay far away from lies be able to thwart the noble goal of peace. End quotation. And he has a line from the Gemara about that it's perfectly permitted to tell a lie for the sake of peace as justification for their behavior. So in this case, when it comes to the command between do we make peace or do we stand up for something that God has commanded, there is back and forth. At times you have to push one, at times you have to push the other. And he seems to suggest there's a sort of calculation that the individual has to make. You have to weigh back and forth the pros and the cons of each. And that Abraham and Mordechai weighed one side, and they pushed one side, suggesting that in those situations it was worth pushing God's command over potential peace. And on the other side, we see Joseph's brothers acting on the conviction that peace was a priority in their specific situation. So let me provide a little conclusion of what I've been talking about so far, how I've been reading Rabag's ethics in his commentary on the Torah. That ethics is not about easy answers. It's about cultivating two different types of virtues, two different types of character traits, one type of traits that teach us or cultivate how we should act for our own needs, our own physical needs, and another which strive to benefit others and strive to work towards the benefit of others with no benefit towards ourselves. In the same way, imitating God's creation of the universe that has no benefit distinctly for him. At the same time, we have to recognize that there are going to be conflicts between these goods and other competing goods. And how do we find? We have to find a method of reconciling. He provides one method that I tried to sort of lay out in that triangle on your sheet. He didn't provide a triangle in his commentary on the Torah. That was after studying it all, I sort of saw these patterns and I tried to map it out in that way. And I would say that for him, the Torah is a guidebook in how to act for ourselves, how to act for others, ethically, of course, and how to act for God, and all at the same time, learning how to face conflicts, how to deal with conflict in life. So anyway, this is my brief interpretation of Ralbug's ethics. My father-in-law is probably trying to find the room right now, and he's lost. But I won't answer in the moment. You can read more about this in my forthcoming book, which is going to be titled Luck, Beneficence, and Conflict in the Ethics of Levi Gersonides. It's not for sale outside yet, but hopefully it will be soon. And you can find a full description of what I briefly touched on. I'm happy to discuss more in some questions.
When is it coming out?
When's it coming out? Hopefully a year. I can't reveal the publisher yet because I'm still in negotiations. So. That's a good question. True. That's a good question. And a tough question that you asked me, too.
Isn't that the same question that you asked through the Bible? God knows what's going to happen.
Yeah, no, you're, well, I think those might be slight. I mean, that's a good question, too. But your question is about if you're saying if a lot of things in this world are luck, how do we explain the fact that, you know, God, shouldn't God be able to sort of see what's going to happen and sort of. Yes, that's a fair question. Do you wanted to. I'm not sure if you could make that blunt. Like, I mean, if it's that quite that simple, I think there are certain sources that do look at, you know, in Mazal Israel. Like, I mean.
Astrological predetermination.
Yeah.
That's getting into whether that's idolatry or not.
Well, he's actually an astrologer himself, and he actually argues that a lot of what we call luck actually is determined by astrology. Actually, astrology is sort of his way of solving the problem.
So his way around this is to be
astrologer. He actually was an astrologer, and he tried in some ways to synthesize the Rambam's rationalism, who was very critical of astrology, with a more astrological approach. And he argued that in theory, if one understood astrology perfectly, one could understand the way God constructed it. I don't know. I mean, if you interpret astrology as inherently Greek, I mean, a lot of
Babylonian.
Jewish thinkers.
The Rambam says it's Babylonian. And
yeah, the Rambam says that. That's true.
Reliable tradition.
Well, he takes.
And he says it's absolute nonsense.
Well, he takes astrology seriously. And, you know, even Ezra did too. Like, there were other thinkers in that period who saw astrology as a serious science. In some ways, astrology is his answer that. If one understands. He argues that we can't really fully know astrology. He says it's an imperfect science. Therefore, we don't. He thinks certain sciences in his mind have been perfected. He thinks medicine. Now, today we might laugh at that, but he thinks medicine has been perfected from the times of those who came before, but he argues that astrology has not been perfected. So, you know, we can measure, he was always measuring the stars. So he said, if we really knew how to measure the stars perfectly, we could really predict what was going to happen. I'll wait. Well, that is a view that you know some hold. I don't know if that holds for Ralbug. I think for him, the Torah is a way of sort of overcoming astrology. It's not just that you're inherently have this. Jews don't inherently have the are above luck, but or astrology, but they have the tools to overcome it. So the Torah is the greatest sort of like guidebook in overcoming it, in his mind at least.
On the
Yeah.
Yeah, very radical. Just compared to Rambam.
Probably why he fell out of favor.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, but that's what Ibn Ezra says there when he talks about that God chooses, God knows in the generality, and when it talks about God going down to see something, that's God choosing to know in the particular. So for Rambam, would he say that there are elements in experience and nature that are, so to speak, under God's radar?
Yes, I think that's sort of partly why he was very strongly criticized, is that, you know, he was criticized as suggesting that God doesn't know exactly everything you're going to do at every moment in your life right this second. God, yes. Sometimes the view that God knows the general you, but he doesn't necessarily know whether you're going to walk to that chair or walk in that direction, right?
Or
maybe he doesn't know the exact sort of route you're going to take around it. He knows the composition. He knows you as a sort of schema, but maybe not exactly what choice you're going to make.
Can you quickly touch on some of the other five things you disagreed with?
I can list them. I didn't completely prepare to go over them, but if I can remember them, let me see. I wrote down that yes, in Milchamot Hashem, in Wars of the Lord, he goes through six issues. Is the rational soul immortal? Number one. Number two, what is the nature of prophecy?
What do you mean by rational soul?
Well, yes, that is a discussion. You're right. That is. I mean, this could be another talk and going through all these. I mean, I'm hesitant to bring it up now, but yeah, exactly. I can't tell you everything in 1 minute, but I'll list them, and maybe that'll be food for future thoughts. The nature of prophecy. So he's criticizing the Rambam on prophecy. On number two. And number three, does God know particulars? How much does God know? Number four, does divine providence, or does providence, hashgacha pratit, extend to individuals, or just hashgacha in general, to individuals? Number five, what is the nature of the astronomical bodies? And that's very tough to read unless you're an astronomer. I tried opening up that section, and I never fully quite figured it out. And number six, is the universe eternal or created? And that was a big debate in the medieval period, and he defended Plato's model of creation, which is creation from, he's famous for creation from some pre-existent matter. So you have Aristotle's position that suggests that the world is eternal and that the universe is eternal because matter can't be created from other matter. You have the view which is more commonly associated with the Torah, which is that creation from nothing. And Rabag defends the position which is the view of Plato, which is that creation was not from nothing but from some kind of potentiality that existed beforehand. Like almost like Plato, that there's some kind of mash and that God gave it form, but it had no form. Now it's a tough view to, you know.
Scientists are still arguing.
Yeah, exactly. Scientists, as we just taught, I just discussed this in my class a few days ago when we were doing a few parts of Maimonides' Guide to the Perplexed, Book 2, Chapter 13, if you've ever looked at it. So there really, he is the first to open up and present these three views, and, you know, Rabag really takes Plato's view and runs with it. But there's a lot of course, debate there. I don't know if we've solved the problem yet, scientifically. I mean, you know, Jewishly, I think we're supporting creation. But scientifically, what did you say?
Scientifically,
you mean the Big Bang? I don't know. Has it been proven 100%?
Just last week.
Oh, with the waves. Yeah, we'll see. Maybe it'll get criticized in a few weeks from now. Any other questions? Or you've all left more confused than you came in? Oh, really? Well, what did you say? Oh, I heard about this novel that he was subject to. Yeah, I heard about this novel. He was a character. They put him in the character in this novel. Yeah. I haven't read it yet. I actually should read it. I don't know if it was based, because we don't know a lot about his life biographically, so I imagine it's more of a historical fiction. There's a few articles that try to piece through his biography. They look at sort of material in southern archives in Provence, and they sort of Professor Schatzmiller, who once lived in Toronto a long time ago, wrote an article on this, trying to piece together his biography of his life. But we don't really 100% know. You can find it. It's in Hebrew and English. Anyways, thank you, everyone, for coming.
Thank you.